two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. I wanted to talk to somebody who has had major impact. We remember her from back in the days when people were really fighting for environmental justice. She was a prominent person in that movement. Her name is Majora Carter. She's from the South Bronx, my old stomping grounds. I'm from Soundview. She's from Hunts Point. That was, you know, a couple of stops away is where you got the, before there was Uber, there were these cabs. I always tell people long before there was an Uber, we had our own Uber and you got off at Hunts Point.
Dollar cabs.
And you got in, you paid a dollar and you sat with whoever was in the cab and it took you up Story Avenue and dropped you off. And it was better than any bus.
Mm-hmm.
It was better than any cab. And it was a lifesaver because they ran, whether it's 3 a.m. or 3 p.m. And so, so when I see folks walk around, they go, oh, I got a Lyft, I got an Uber. I go, nah, we had it way back in the day. So, you know, because your area was where we got them.
Exactly. No, it's like, it's so funny. I haven't even thought about dollar cabs in a decade or more, but you're totally right. That's what they were. I'd like get on up down here and go visit my friends up in Soundview. Yep. Catch a dollar cab over by Hunts Point Avenue subway station. So,
and the thing, you know. and the thing is that we had to do that because the yellow cabs wouldn't come up to our area in the Bronx.
Mm-mm.
And, you know, in many ways, and this is kind of related to your book, which is why we have you on. She's written a book called Reclaiming Your Community. You don't have to move out of your neighborhood to live in a better one. I think of it in terms of this was ingenuity, this was resourcefulness, this was actually an invention out of necessity, but was much better than the real deal. You know, I didn't want to go back to a cab because when you went into those dollar cabs, you heard the music you liked, you went directly to where you needed to go. I didn't have to, and it was there all hours of the night and the day. And you felt like you were reinvesting back in the community. It's like, I didn't mind giving it to homie who was driving the cab. But I say all that to say that in reading your book, Reclaiming Your Community, you talk about, and I'll let you start talking. You really talk about reinvesting in the people that are there, bringing up the talent and looking for a new way in which we can go about improving our lot. So let's talk about the premise of your book. I kind of gave an overview and just what stood out for me, but you wrote it, so.
Yes. Well, thank you. And no, that reinvestment that you're talking about, it first of all means that we've got something to invest to begin with. And it sort of challenges this notion that there's no value in our communities while we're in it. And so reclaiming, the way that I use it, means that we don't need to measure our success by how far we get away from our communities, because there's already value in them.
Right.
And reclaiming involves reclaiming the talent that was already there, that was born and raised in our communities, you know, who built up our own hustles in all sorts of different ways. Instead of using them and taking them out and measuring our success by how far we get away, we're actually using it to improve our surroundings and our own economic future.
In your book, you talk about doing a survey, and in the survey, you talked about, what people wanted in a community. And, you know, can you talk a little bit about that? Because, let me just make sure I remember how everything just broke down. You know, we talk about the things that we immediately need, community centers, better schools, et cetera, et cetera. But in order to keep people there, you know, we want a movie theater and a park and all these other amenities, which usually leads to us leaving, you know, the area.
Exactly. Yep. We call those things lifestyle infrastructure, right? Mm-hmm. And it's basically the things that support your own lifestyle that make you feel like the place where you are is worth staying in. It's attractive. And so what we're trying to do is entice the talent that's born and raised in our community to kind of take a second look and realize that, no, there's stuff here that can keep me here. Because when that talent stays, you know, number one, they keep their financial spending power in those communities. They keep their example in the community. And it also, on a certain level, especially at least for some of us, it means that many of those of who are often selling their property to predatory speculators because they believe that there's no real value in the community. So why keep it? They're keeping that asset, which in turn will help them, you know, create and maintain generational wealth.
You stayed in the South Bronx.
Yes.
And for people who don't know, I'm in the South Bronx with a rough and tumble time when I came up in the 70s, fires everywhere, became the poster child. But you said a couple of things about that. One, even though as devastating as it was, you never felt unsafe. And mm-hmm. I would often say the same thing, like this was home. I'd rather have been there or in Harlem than anywhere else because, you know, even though all the stuff was there, there was still a sense of community. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that because I think that's oftentimes overlooked. And I think we're often gaslit to believe that something is wrong if we stay in the hood, you know? And if we do stay in the hood, then instead of really talking about the good parts, community, family, you had a family of 10, et cetera, we wound up telling war stories. Oh, I was in the South Bronx and 50 people got shot and I went to Stevenson High. You know, and you start to tell all these crazy stories versus really just be like, yo, this was like, it was actually kind of cool. It's where hip hop started. it was rough, but it was also memorable.
Yep. And I bet you remember some of those, like the block parties and the parties in the Pox would basically DJs would come with two turntables and a microphone and it was like the jam. So you remember that. I was little too, but I totally remember it. And it was just like, what is this magic that's happening around us? But to your point, you know, look, and one of my brothers was killed, you know, through gang violence. You know, I did watch many buildings burn down. You know, we lost plenty of people. But at the same time, you're 100% right. Like I never felt that I was personally, you know, in any kind of danger because I did have the people that cared about me. We lost a lot of people because, especially in this part, you know, of the South Bronx, because we lost so much of the just the buildings were just, most of them were burned down. Yeah. I mean, it was just crazy, like walking through it. It felt like you were in a war zone of like, you know, broken, banged up buildings that were just gone. And, you know, It was pretty horrifying at times, but I never felt alone and I never felt like it was a terrible place because there was love here and you're 100% right. And it's that love that I'm going back to, that community feeling, because community is not just a place, it's an activity. And when you've got people in a community who are exercising, you know, that muscle of love to, you know, to support the people that are there, then suddenly it's a whole different place. And so reclaiming, you know, your community for me here is just like, it's adding a layer on top of that. That's all about, you know, helping us understand that we do have the tools for our own recovery in place. We just have to like figure out ways to manipulate everything else that's coming in around us so that we're the ones actually doing it and taking full advantage of our community getting better.
Majora Carter is our guest. Let me ask you, how much do we have to look and take into account systemic outside forces that decimate our hood? I mean, we talked about the burnt out buildings, and I think by now people know about the landlords that were behind it and insurance companies. But you really cut your teeth at looking at illegal dumping that was going on in the South Bronx and helped transform one of those places into a park. You know, we're dealing with illegal dumping all the way here in Oakland, as I'm sure many other cities. And so it's always these outside entities that come in and then they blame us for the conditions that exist. So you would think that, you know, Majora is just lazy. You know, she's throwing out, you know, beds in her backyard, or Dave is lazy because, you know, I'm sitting here looking at a mattress across the street. Like I just woke up and just dragged the mattress out and put it there. And nobody wants to talk about the folks that came in from another city, dumped it off, and then did these things. But let's talk a little bit about that, because it contributes to perception.
Yes.
And it contributes to internal perception that has us believe, like, maybe this is who I am.
Right. No, and that's exactly, you know, what I talk about when I just said, when I often say, you know, you don't, it's the legacy, you know, and the impact of white supremacy, you know, on our minds and on our communities. When we feel as though there's somehow something wrong, you know, with us, because we are what we are, despite the fact that there's been, you know, legacy, you know, history, I mean, literally more than 400 years, you know, worth of systemic racism, you know, classism that literally created our communities where we are, right? And so, of course, we're not immune to it, but we do have to push it back and realize that, wait a second, that was an issue that's designed to keep us where we are so that we feel as though we have to move. And that we can't really do anything here. And that in turn impacts our entire, the trajectory of our communities. Because, you know, when you think about, you know, gentrification generally means, you know, outsiders coming in to make a change to suit their own needs. Whereas reclaiming involving the talent that's already there to improve the quality of life for the people that are there. So first and foremost, we have to recognize that the lies that are coming in about us are not true. You know, like when I look at, you know, it's really interesting, but we've got, you know, there's like plenty of, you know, drop-in centers and drug rehab and homeless shelters here. And, you know, a bunch of the people that come in that we see in our community that are looking really afflicted, you know, they're white. So they ain't from around here, but we get the all of the feeling like, oh, there's something wrong with our neighbor and this is all our neighborhood. And I'm just like, they're not even from around here. Like, what are you talking about?
Right.
And so I just feel like that those type of things, like, and also the same ones that you mentioned, are also part of the way that makes us feel as though our communities don't have any value. And
right.
So we've got to like flip that script in our own heads first before we can even start thinking about like, oh, so what are we going to do to change it? But first we have to acknowledge that it can be changed, and we can't change it by just moving, because I don't think that I don't think the talent retention is going to solve gentrification, but I don't think gentrification can be solved without talent retention.
Right. Real talk on that. I think, you know, you said something, I don't want it to go over people's heads, but you talked about in the book and just now, you know, like the people that came to Hunts Point, which was, you know, made famous for a lot of people because they talked about the prostitution, and it has been a series, you know, at the point or something like that that came out. So that's how
HBO series Hookers at Hunts Point. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's how a lot of people start to know that area. But as you pointed out, living there, it was people that came from outside of Hunts Point.
Oh, yeah.
That frequent these, you know, went to the hookers, that mm-hmm. that brought the drugs. So they came from the nice areas, that came from the Riverdales and mm-hmm. where I lived at one point, came from, you know, other parts of the Bronx and Manhattan to these places. I bring this up because you were one of the rare people who was able to get a house. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, if you didn't buy a house mm-hmm. early on, if you were around in the 70s and into the 80s, it was impossible if you lived in a neighborhood to buy a house. They would not give you the loans. You know, mm-hmm. our parents wanted to buy and couldn't, and we wound up moving out, right? Mm-hmm. And I bring this up because all these systemic conditions that you talked about that we get blamed for mm-hmm. was the reason why they said, well, you know, there might be a fire. It might be this, it might be that. So let's talk about how we transform that, because then all of a sudden, the South Bronx becomes Sobro, right? As they were calling it. And all of a sudden there were people that might move from California that could get a loan to buy a house in a neighborhood that our parents couldn't buy one.
Right.
So can we talk about that legacy? Because that's where you start to see gentrification, and you found yourself in the crosshairs.
Oh, totally.
you know,
I still am. That's just part of the way it goes. But yeah, my dad bought our house, the house I grew up in, back in the 1940s. And the way he did it was he won $15,000 playing the ponies out in LA. He was a Pullman porter and literally because no, a black man wasn't going to get no real kind of loan back in the 1940s. So he had cash, plunked it down, and literally couldn't live or didn't feel like he could live in the house that he bought for 2 years. The neighborhood was all white and he did not feel it was safe for him to be there.
Wow.
Didn't. So he just rented it back to the family that was there for 2 whole years before my mom came, before he married my mom rather. And, so it was really interesting that, you know, that 50 years later, like I was able to squat a house across the street from the one I grew up in because nobody wanted it. Nobody Right. wanted it until literally my block ended up on the front page of like the real estate section of the New York Times one day, like while I'm in the process of trying to, you know, acquire this house legally. And it said, I think the headline was something like, you know, South Bronx, the next frontier in real estate development, something like that. And then within, I swear, like weeks, a predatory speculator obtained a fraudulent deed on my house and tried to evict me. And it took me 2 years to actually go through all the legal channels. I had to go to landlord-tenant court. Meanwhile, I've been in this house. My family had been in the house for like decades at that point. Right. But it took like forever. Two whole years. And I think I lost like several years of my life, like just the stress right. of that, because it was bad. It was bad. But eventually I got it. But again, but the thing is, what I often see is that there are so many folks who don't understand that the, you know, financial literacy and real estate development and the fact that you know, property will go up, real estate does this, and you know, if you want to stay in it, so it goes up. And since we're not led to believe that our communities have much value, you know, so many folks just like sell early and cheap right. because we don't believe it. And then we get mad when we realize, you know, that like, oh my gosh, look at the way the neighborhood's changing. Or wow, you know, the house that, you know, my family owned a long time ago is worth like all this money, you know, but we left. And now I'm like, no. So part of what this reclaiming your community, what I hope becomes something that people really take to heart is like, take a second look at your own neighborhood. You know, ask yourself, why are these predatory speculators circling and right. looking at like figuring out like, how do they change the name of our communities from what it is to something that they like more?
Yeah.
Right. And just ask them, ask ourselves that, like, they know there's value in our communities. Do we believe there's value in our communities?
Right. You know, I want to make sure that people have context when you talk about squatting, mm-hmm. you know, because okay. squatting in the minds of many people kind of became popularized on the Occupy movement, right? Mm-hmm. And it's basically, you know, people go to abandoned buildings and take them over. What are y'all going to do? You know, and that sort of thing. But in your case, squatting was really an act of love. Mm-hmm. And what we saw in the South Bronx, a lot of times, people's buildings got burnt out, yep. right? And the houses got damaged. Or in the case of your squatting, quotations around it, the neighbor got sick.
Yeah,
and totally. Didn't have family to take care of her. Mm-hmm. And so your family for decades took care of that person to her dying day.
Literally.
And things that we don't do in our community, we don't write wills, we don't know about transfers, we don't do all these different things. We don't pay yep. the taxes on the building, yep. but you all exactly. took care of
yep.
this person's thing. And for the most part, that was not an uncommon type of situation. Mm-mm. In the South Bronx. I mean, there's a movie called Decades of Fire mm-hmm. to really talk about, you know, people rebuilding in the neighborhoods. Like, look, right. you know, the buildings are burnt out. Ain't nobody going to do it. We will do it.
Right. Exactly.
And then exactly. after everything is done, then somebody comes in and goes, hey, you mm-hmm. know, let's put this house on the front page
yeah.
of the real estate section and then say, this is the new frontier. And then all of a sudden somebody from Timbuktu somewhere mm-hmm. wants to buy and then have all the legalese and then like you don't have the deed, right. blah, blah, right. blah.
And that's what's really interesting here is that, you know, when I think about like the like literally the burning Bronx, and I am so appreciative of like all the work, you know, that was done, you know, back in the 70s in particular to just like, you know, take over some of those buildings and really like push, you know, the federal government, you know, to really think about how do we rebuild here. The only thing that I wish had happened is that there had been more, you know, attention paid to actually ownership.
Yeah.
Because that's the problem. Because if the, because quite frankly, you know, regular developers, you know, and supported by philanthropy, you know, and government really understood that if you, that the subsidies to build affordable rental housing, which we desperately needed, we lost 60% of our population in the Bronx in the 1970s because of the fires and all sorts of other things, but that was a big thing. So rebuilding the housing was great, but you can't tell me that, you know, that the people who benefited very, very well from the rebuilding of the Bronx was actually private interest from outside of our community.
After the muscle and sweat was done by the people who lived there.
Yes. And so we didn't own it.
Yeah.
We don't own it. And that's the problem. You know, again, we're still, you know, that's why I think affordable housing, like advocates, you know, God, really, God bless them, because we need more of it, but we needed it in different ranges as well. And also we need to be pushing also for ownership. And if if there was like more opportunities for there to be like, you know, folks who were just like, okay, we're going to take this over and squat and be like, nope, ours now, let's make it legal. then it would be a completely different way that our community had developed over the past 30 years. Let's start something now.
It's interesting you mention that. You talk about your experience in the industrial nonprofit industry. And one of the things that stands out as you talk about is like people like the status quo. As long as you're poor majora, you know, who needs, then it's good. You can become the poster child, but nobody will sit there and say, you know, sister, you need to like sign these papers and own your intellectual property. You need to own, like nobody ever told me about owning my intellectual property until, you know, it was too late. And all of a sudden people had picked your brain, built ideas off it, made money, and then moved on. And you talk about it in the book that, you know, here you are on the covers of magazines and things like that. And people were literally like, well, we don't compensate people, but you know, we might be able to get you some publicity, and that can lead to maybe somebody helping you. You know, I mean, it's literally people will do that now. They'll say, why don't you all come perform for us for free? And that will give you exposure. Like, and
how'd
then
you find out about me?
Yeah,
I'm already exposed. Okay, thank you very much. No, here's my fee.
But it's a new way. It's a slick way of pimping people for their stuff. And nobody pulls you to the side and say, look, if you sign these papers and you own, then you can control. But let me complicate this, because this seems to be a problem you ran into. We also have a thing of like, we totally reject the system. There's a train of thought. We ain't going to do what they do. That's the European way. So when you start talking about ownership, then all of a sudden you're a capitalist.
Right.
And you're a potential exploiter. You're somebody who is working with the system. Mm-hmm. And if people don't know you, you can get caught up in that type of milieu in terms of, oh, you're one of them. Right. So how do we navigate that and really control and own? I know you break this down in the book, but maybe you can give us a couple of tips before I let you go.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's also, again, the legacy of white supremacy kind of like makes us believe that somehow or another, we're not supposed to do certain things, right? So we're not authentic if we like take in like some of the things, the same things, in fact, that literally made, you know, why the racial wealth gap is as big as it is, right? There were hundreds of years of entitlement programs for white people that literally made it so that, starting with like things even prior to the Homesteaders Act, that literally gave tracts of land taken from Native Americans to white families, okay? Literally down to the GI Bill. There were Black families that fought, right? They didn't get that kind of money, but white folks did, and they built it. So my thing is like, why would we not, since we know that the key to the stability of our communities is creating the kind of generational wealth that we need. If y'all can come up with another way to do it, amen, I'd like to hear it. But in the meantime, I'm not, you know, and I'm sure the people smarter, way smarter than I ever will be, will try to figure out, and we'll figure out how to do something. But in the meantime, all I want to do is just use some of the tools that are out there to increase and improve the quality of life for folks. So if that means ownership opportunities, if that means creating the foundational elements of that for our communities to benefit, then that's what I'm gonna try to do. No shade to anybody who's like trying to do something else. Amen. God bless you. And like, do it well. I'll copy you. Right. I will. But in the meantime, let's like do what we can with the tools that are readily out there. And it doesn't mean that like I'm as black as I'm ever gonna be. All right. Blackity, right. black. Like you can't take that from me. I don't care what you call me.
Well, people would say cooperative ownership, but when I'm looking at the story of the house that you eventually got, that's pretty much what it was. It was your family of 10, 12 people cooperatively owning or trying to.
Eventually,
But at the end of the day, if your name is not on that paper.
Or somebody's name, and I don't care.
Somebody gets moved out.
Exactly.
I remember Rebel Diaz, you know, they had an arts collective. They took over a factory off of Southern Street.
Yes.
You know, they took over that factory. They used the neighborhood talent. They talked about, you know, the guy who was drunk, but was really an electrician. People came in and built it. But at the end of the day, when Bloomberg didn't like their activities, you know, because they were speaking out about the police, somebody was able to walk up and go, yeah, this is good that you all did this and you did all this stuff, but we own it.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day,
they did. You know, somebody else did.
Somebody else owned it, and then people were moved out. Right. So you break this down in the book excellently about the types of steps we need to take. And I know your time is short, so let everybody know about the book and leave us with, you know, either a couple of chapters you want us to really pay attention to, or a couple of tidbits that you want us to really further investigate Majora Card.
Yeah. So I would think that. So first of all, you just buy the book wherever books are sold. Although I encourage you to buy from a local bookstore. That's straight up. But the things that I'd like for people to remember, you know, you want to, you know, build mixed income, you know, both housing as well as commercial development, not in exclusively low income places, specifically to create economic diversity. You want homeowners to like maximize the long-term value of their property so that they can and not do the quick sell offers, you know, from predatory speculators. And you want to keep people in dollars in our own communities to develop those like really vibrant third spaces. Like when you come back to the Boogie Down Grind. That's the cafe.
It's amazing. Yeah.
You know, it's just, there's so much going on in there. And just remember, poverty is not a cultural attribute for any of us. So, and we need to recognize that the talent has always been in our communities. We really, really need to understand that. We just need to keep it there to help support us all.
Repeat that last part again, because you say it throughout the book. Poverty is not a culture.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the thing that people want to operate when they engage us, which is why they wouldn't say ownership, which is why they wouldn't say these things like, you just want to be poor. So, you know, I'm not going to tell you how to do these things. Yeah, we're going to help you stay that way.
We're going to help you sort of like maintain, you know, and like make it sort of, you know, more comfortable for you to be in your poverty, because God forbid, we don't want you to like, you know, try to do what we do with our lives and our children and anything else. And I'm like, no, I think, you know, people in our communities know and appreciate and love nice things too. We want our children to do better. We want the places around us to be wonderful. So, you know, and again, when we ask people, what do you want in a neighborhood that you aspire to be in? It was the same kind of things anybody else would want in their neighborhood. You know, great places to live, work, play, you know, feel comfortable in, feel like, you know, they've got something to look forward to. Whether it was a nice cafe, a cool park, you know, places to be. It's like community is a place, but you need, but it's also an activity, and you need places to build community that make you feel like you're building something great.
Real talk. Reclaiming your community. You don't have to move out of your neighborhood to live in a better one, by Majora Carter, who's our guest. And I guess the last thing I'll just ask you, should we be selling our homes if we live in East Oakland, West Oakland, South Bronx, South Side Chicago?
Child, please, no. I mean, if you get just look at the title of that book. No, reclaiming your daggone community. You don't do that. I mean, I don't care. You find somebody in your own neighborhood if you want to sell it. You know, yeah, they got to get a mortgage. Yes, it'll take longer than some like, you know, sleazy guy showing up at your house or calling you and going, I'm willing to buy your house for cash and closing in a week. beware of those people. They are not there to support you, your community, your race.
But I need some money. Well, then they're offering $10,000. I need that money. I could sell grandma's house.
Yeah, but you if you hold on to it, you know, I'm sorry. I'll tell you, because this is the truth. I ate oatmeal and eggs. Pretty much that was it for a really long time while I went through the process. Deal with it. That little bit of the kind of thing you got to put yourself through, and will absolutely, you won't even remember it in the long term. And that's the thing. We've got to stop thinking about like this really short term thing. That's another thing that the people who look at low status communities look at, where it's just like, there's no, you know, we only think about like what's in right in front of us. We're not playing the long game. And that's where they get us.
Real talk there. Majora, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. We'll look out for your book, Reclaiming Your Community. Definitely get it at your local bookstore, you know, independent bookstore. Shout out to Marcus Bookstore, you know, where we're at. Yep. We'll have to go visit the Boogie Down Cafe once we, you know, if I make my way back to the Big Apple. But
you have to.
Thank you for joining us. We're going to take a break, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
And my last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
My guest is a cat who I'm used to introducing him as a trumpeter, but over the years that has expanded and continued to expand. Keyboards, piano, bass, vocals, all around cat Nicholas Payton. Nicholas is in town this weekend, or this week. He kicks off tomorrow night over at the Black Cat in San Francisco, and we'll be hanging out over there through Sunday. And if you haven't been to the Black Cat, this is a great opportunity to get out. It's a nice place to check out some music, and it's bringing in cats like Nicholas Payton. What's happening, Cat?
What's up, G1? What's happening, bro?
Oh, good, man. Good to have this face-to-face, brother, although I'm glad we've been staying in touch over the time.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure.
As I mentioned, you're going to be in town, and that's going to have a couple of different looks to it, right?
Yeah, we're doing trio Wednesday and Thursday nights with Ben Williams on bass and Bill Stewart on drums.
Right on.
And then Friday starts the reunion of my quintet. It'll be a 25-year reunion. We started in 97. We went like for 5 years. So we haven't really played in over 20 years as a group.
Oh, right on. But you know, with you, a trio is more than a trio. I mean, it's just a trio in numbers only. But
fair enough.
Hey, let's talk about that. When you began to expand, you know, I saw you with Lenny White and Vicente, and that was my first time seeing you really beginning to step out front on piano as well as trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
When did that actually begin for you, and how did you know it was time to make that move?
Bet. I started doing that, the whole keyboard, trumpet, simultaneous comping for myself thing around 06, right after the flood in New Orleans. I started this weekend series at a club called Snug Harbor. And I just started experimenting with comping for myself. I was talking to a guru, one of my trumpet mentors, Clyde Kerr Jr., who taught me at NOCA, but even years before that, he was one of the people really responsible for influencing me to even play the trumpet. One of New Orleans' finest artists, musicians, trumpeters, Clyde Kerr Jr. And we were having a talk, as we often did, and he was just telling me about, you know, seeing somebody, I think it was Clarence Ford, great New Orleans tenor saxophonist, comp for himself while playing. And I was like, wow, that's deep. I wonder how that would work with the trumpet. So I started doing that. But it would be years later before I did it like an exclusive thing as a concept. As you know, you can imagine, it's not easy to do.
Right.
And it's funny because when I was at Snug, I had started getting a grip on it. And then one night some cat came up to me. He was like, man, that's incredible. Like, I don't know how you're doing that. You're in two keys at once. So I had to relearn it, how to do it to be more stable. So he had, what was a minor setback, actually, he did me a favor because it caused me to go more solidly into what I was actually doing, to be in a more stable place. And then I guess around 2012, I had a group called the Sextet, and I truncated that to a trio, and just myself and Vicente and whatever drummer du jour. One of the first drummers I started using was Lenny White in that context, and we worked as a trio for about a year, and that was my first album on my own label that I put out, Live at Bohemian Caverns, BAM, Live at
right.
Bohemian Caverns, which came out, I think, in 2013.
Man, so you termed it as a concept, which is cool. Some people would use that as a gimmick, you know,
mm-hmm.
something to just show, you know, that they can sort of do these two things at once, but not really. But with you, I mean, I've seen it. I've seen you play. To me, it sounds like this is a pianist who's playing, not a trumpet player who's playing piano, not, you know, this gimmick thing that's going on. Mm-hmm. It sounds like a pianist and feels like a pianist. You know, mm-hmm. when I was listening to Letters, I mean, that to me was just like, wow, this is a nice trio going on here. You know, when is Nicholas coming in? So for you, talk about the not having it become a gimmick, right, having it really be what you're doing.
Right, right. Well, the interesting thing to me is, you know, I kind of would have been cool with even being characterized as a gimmick if it meant like somehow people being more accepting of it. The interesting thing about it all was that, you know, I got a lot of resistance from the jazz folks because I was doing this thing. And I was like, only in jazz would somebody doing it be a setback.
Right.
Like any other genre, people would be going crazy over somebody playing two instruments at once.
Right, this is Prince or Stevie, yeah, or, you know, yeah, right.
Any other genre, they would be lauding me and saying I was a genius for doing it. Only in jazz are people like hating on me, like, oh, why is he doing that? And the funny thing is, the misconception is that somehow I was playing less trumpet, which is not the case. I mean, I was playing every bit as much of trumpet solos as I would in a normal set. Right. The only difference is that I was comping for myself while I was playing, and I was usually taking keyboard solos. So really, I was working harder than I was working before. But people having a fixed concept because I'm not standing out in front, really you're getting more Nicholas Payton than you were before, because I would spend 75% of the time just standing on the side of the stage doing nothing.
Right.
And after a while, that just became boring to me. Like, I was like, I want to be more a part of the music that's unfolding. I don't want to just take a trumpet solo and stand on the side of the stage for 3/4 of the set. And I feel like there've been so many great trumpet players, so many great artists to stand flat-footed for so many decades. That's been done so many times in so many different ways brilliantly. But with this trumpet keyboard thing in tandem, I'm at the precipice of creating a voice, creating a culture, I'm at the vanguard of creating a new way of expression, of creating a new type of instrument almost. But as it is with a lot of things, when you're the first, amongst the first to do something, you know, it's not always easiest for you. You know, the person who kicks the door down doesn't necessarily receive all of the love as once it becomes more established and standardized, so to speak.
Nicholas Payton, our guest, and Nicholas will be over at the Black Cat in San Francisco beginning tomorrow night. He's going to be there tomorrow through Sunday, first with his trio and then with his quintet reunion. And Nicholas also has a new recording out, Smoke Sessions, on Smoke Sessions Records. I like the fact that you don't sit still. And by that, I mean, like, we just went through a period of time where everyone was asked to sit still, to stay in place. During that time, you still found ways, though, to remain creative and to share your creativity, you know, through the various forms of social media, but also with Maestro Rhythm King, you know, that recording. And one that really caught my ears because to me it spoke directly to other things that were happening at that time, not just, you know, not just the pandemic, not just us sheltering in place, but also the racism, the racial discord that was going on in this country. When you came with the song We Will Breathe, which I definitely consider one of the current day freedom songs, you know, one of those liberation songs. Mm. Tell me about that, We Will Breathe. You know, the thought that went into putting that together, the significance of saying, the significance of an affirmation like We Will Breathe.
Absolutely. Yeah, a lot of layers. So the project itself is something that kind of started around the top of the pandemic. And it's a collaborative effort between myself and Marcus Gilmore, who I met through his grandfather, Roy Haynes, when I was in his band. So at the top of the pandemic, we started working on this project in collaboration with our mutual friend and Brandon Baker. And Brandon is friends with Kwame S. Brathwaite, who's the son of Kwame Brathwaite, who's a photographer, very instrumental in helping to establish the Black is Beautiful movement back in the 60s. And a big theme of his photographs was taking pictures of very beautiful Black women with their Afrocentric feet, highlighting their Afrocentric features and not catering to a Eurocentric standard of beauty. So basically this project started with, because we were all in lockdown, Marcus and I bouncing and sending tracks back and forth to each other remotely. And so Marcus sent me his drums, and he also was playing some keys on that. So the second section, when it goes into the actual We Will Breathe chant, those are his chords. And I filled it out and played key bass and layered it with some other keys. And we had a bunch of guest female voices on the project as well. I came up with that title, We Will Breathe, because I am not so much of a fan of a lot of the modern slogans that have been used in the Black movement. Like, I can't breathe. I feel like back in the day, we had slogans that were affirmative, like, I am a man, we shall overcome. So why we started chanting things like, I can't breathe, or, you know, hands up, don't shoot, which I think reinforces traumas and negativity. So the idea of We Will Breathe is a way of reclaiming our power and not asking, not preaching that our life matters to a group of people who perhaps seem intent on not considering us, that we're not asking, we're saying, we're claiming, and we're taking our power. And that's the energy that song comes out of, and the energy of the whole album we're working on.
Hey, well, folks would get a chance to hear Nicholas Payton tomorrow through Sunday at the Black Cat in San Francisco. Two sets each night?
Two sets, except for Friday and Saturday, which I think are three sets.
Okay.
Yeah,
man. Well, I'm looking forward to getting over there and checking out some music myself. But, you know, in the meantime, bro, thanks for your time, man. And, man, thanks for doing things the way that you do it. You know, no matter what else it may look like out there, there are those of us out here who appreciate that.
And I appreciate you for always standing down for my projects and supporting. Likewise, much appreciative of you and your support over the years.
Right on, brother.
Matter of the moment is composed with black light. Black culture matter in the molecules of America. This is the part of the nightmare where we wake up inside the dream. There is image still quiet, so loud we cannot breathe.
Later. Ha!
for Hard Knock Radio. East, west, north, south, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous. Speaking to the thugs, one love. We know where y'all at. Pop, Brown Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415's bumping Hard Knock Radio, Brown Buffalo. All up in your stereo. Yo, and to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard cops. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side. Learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard cops. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side.
Try Jesus, not me. 'Cause I throw hands. Try Jesus, please don't try me. Because I'm fine. I know what he said about getting slapped. But if you touch me or mine, we gon' have to scrap. So try Jesus, please don't try me, because I'm fine. I have no problem laying these hands. Try Jesus, don't try me, 'cause I throw hands. Try Jesus, please don't try me, because I'm fine.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk, don't stop. EMN at it again, Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris, Juwan, Kim. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation, simulation. Step into the zone, the Bay Area zone. Hard Knock, radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though.
Yeah.
Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't gone all in and ain't paid the cost for the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till it ready from the steel gray beats. They bleed. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great red making. Second piece to the lovers, our neighbor to please. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. Let's go. Hey, we're meeting David G.
Real Talk Radio. You are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast.
Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.